You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a consumer technology expert helps us figure out what to do with all those old photos and documents, collecting dust in the attic or taking up space on our phone or our computer. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about watching chimney swifts at dusk.
We all have a lot of things to cross off our to-do list. Have you taken out the trash? Are the bills paid? Laundry folded? And if you're writer Catherine Jago, have you paused and turned your gaze skyward at dusk to witness the dance of the chimney swifts?
On August 31st, I hear that the chimney swifts are roosting in the brick chimney at Our Lady Queen of Peace Church. At summer's end, swifts mass in great flocks at dusk as they prepare to migrate south. My husband and I resolved to go there after dinner. It isn't an auspicious evening, cloudy and spitting with rain. We're bickering as we get into the car, anxious we'll be late. We arrive at 7:10, and I scurry ahead, clutching my binoculars, in search of the right chimney. I see nothing in the sky. We come to an expansive parking lot at the back of the church. Some minivans have pulled up, and people are sitting next to them on lawn chairs, chatting companionably. Two women are lying face up in an empty paddling pool. There are kids of various ages tooling around on the blacktop on bicycles and scooters, impervious to the drizzle. We join a small knot of birders gathered around an elderly gentleman in a wheelchair, wearing a tweed hat with a plaid woolen blanket tucked around his knees. I see only two swifts, tiny and high up. They look like cigars on wings, with the same rapid fluttering as bats or scraps of burned paper. But as the minutes pass, they multiply as if conjured out of the air. Now I can hear their high, sweet chittering. For a while, they swirl around in all directions, but gradually they cohere into loose ovals, the skein bulging this way, then that, above the rooftops. The old man is as excited as a boy. "Mother and I never saw this many," he exclaims, pointing skyward with a tremulous forefinger, his enthusiasm infectious. "Another first. Pretty good for a 91-year-old, his daughter says affectionately. I keep checking my watch. Our necks begin to ache, gazing up. Sunset is at 7:34, although tonight it's only a glow in the dense cloud. As 7:30 approaches, the chimney seems to exert a magnetic attraction. Individual swifts dive towards it. Most pull out of the turn and veer off, but the odd one vanishes. At 1 minute before sunset, the flock's loose swirling picks up energy, like water circling around a drain, and suddenly they're pouring themselves down the chimney, as if down a funnel, and vanishing. I imagine the commotion inside the chimney, hundreds of small birds jockeying for a perch on the masonry with their tiny claws. I wonder if they prefer certain spots, higher up or lower down, and how they all get into such a tight space without colliding or hurting one another. When all of them are gone, there is soft applause. Someone says, "Sleep well, guys." I stand leaning into my husband, who has his arms around me from behind. When I turn around, people are dotted all over the parking lot in twos and threes, staring up, smiling. They have appeared out of nowhere, like the swifts. It wasn't a spectacular sunset, or a spectacular number of birds, 300 or 400 at most. But there's a collective sense of peace and pleasure. I resolve to come back at dusk, whenever I can, before they leave.
Catherine Jago is a translator and writer whose most recent poetry collections are Bloodroot and News from the North. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Now, I mentioned on the show last week that I had recently digitized some old slides for a relative, and this got me thinking about all the other pictures laying around. That big tote full of, you know, printed off film pictures, files and files of photos and videos on a computer, that old camera with a tape. I don't know what to do with that. I'm probably not the only one, I reckoned, who looks at those boxes of photos and memorabilia and feels overwhelmed at the prospect of sorting and digitizing everything. It's not just analog stuff like photos and documents. How about home videos recorded on older formats like VHS, Betamax, Super 8? Not to mention, once we've done all the legwork of scanning and uploading, what are the best ways to organize and protect the files for the future? Our next guest has been answering questions like this for over 25 years, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you organize and preserve your own photos and videos? Do you have questions for our guest about digitizing photos, videos, maybe even documents? Maybe you're a seasoned pro and you have solutions to share with us. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. J.D. Beersdorfer has been writing about consumer technology for the New York Times since 1998. She's the author or co-author of 8 books on consumer technology topics and co-hosts the podcast Pop Tech Jam. J.D., thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me here.
I understand, J.D., you've been working on your own family archives lately. Help me. How did you start?
First of all, you really just have to go through all the boxes. I've recently inherited a family archive of stuff and were finding all kinds of things, including tintypes, I think, from the late 19th century. But before you get started, I think it's very important to go through all of the boxes, all of the slide carousels, all of the photo albums, see what you've got, take an inventory, and then figure out what's really worth digitizing and maybe what was not really a good shot even back then that you don't need to save. And then once you have all of this stuff and figure out how many formats and things you're dealing with, then sort of make a plan about how you want to go about doing your digitization work. And I think I mispronounced that. It's a long afternoon here on Eastern time.
It works for me. Now, JD, I want to dig into something you mentioned there. I've got all these photos, some in print, some, you know, zillions of pictures of my kids when they were precious little babies. In one mood, I'll destroy lots of stuff. In another, I'm like, I can't imagine getting rid of everything. How do we get in the right lane in determining how much we want to keep and how we set our priorities for what we want to save in the first place?
Well, I think you go, I mean, obviously there's always the top tier photos that everyone remembers passing around. You know, clearly those are the winners that you want to keep. If there are old family members that you know, a lot of people don't remember, maybe you want to have some reference point for them. When I was going through my own mother's archive, I was finding a lot of photos of people we had no idea who they were. We weren't related to them. And then also, my grandfather was a big fan of the Ektachrome slides in the mid-century America, and so he would always take slides. And so we've got tons and tons of carousels. But he would also buy slides in the store, and so I would be going through his carousels, figuring out which ones I wanted to convert. And I would see all these store-bought ones of, like, Mount Rushmore. I was like, well, I don't really need to keep that. So I think, you know, you want to get the ones that are deeply personal to you and that just really evoke a strong memory, or they're people that are gone from your life that you want to have this record of them. And start there, and then kind of work your way down. Obviously, I think every family's probably got some duds in the batch that you can just sort of push aside, and those will be pretty obvious. You know, here's the picture of Dad's thumb, you know, when he misfired the camera.
The photos are the duds, not the family members.
Yeah. The photos would be the duds. And there's some too, like when you're going through and you see some prints that are maybe damaged because they've been stored improperly, or they're cracked and they're scratched. Don't throw those out immediately, because thanks to the miracle of software, you can also repair those digitally once you get them scanned. So even if it looks like it's a hopeless case, there's things you can do in photo editing programs that can really revive your photos.
Let's talk about some of the how-to here. And let's start with those slides you mentioned. And that was my starting point here. I'm fortunate my parents are more tech-savvy than I am. I borrowed a slide converter that you can plug into your computer. What's out there for either technology we can use at home, or you know, are there services we can go to if we don't want to screw around with doing it ourselves?
Yeah, the answer is a yes to both. You mentioned that your parents had a slide scanner. Clearly, they were not messing around with their slides. And if you have a ton that you want to personally scan, investing in the hardware like a dedicated slide scanner that hooks into your computer is a good way to do it. It's time consuming because you're sort of going through. You can go one by one. Sometimes you can gang them up depending on the model. If you've just got a handful of slides and you want to play around, there's actually smartphone apps that you can do that will capture transparency, either film negative or slides. It can be a little hinky just with the getting it to focus right. But if you just got a handful and you just really want to get these few photos, it's a low cost investment to capture. That way, Kodak makes a little box thing that opens up, and you can put film and slides in that and put your smartphone on top and capture the film that way. It illuminates it from the bottom. Because that's the thing, as you know, with transparencies, you have to illuminate them from the back so that you can see the image. Since that would be normally how you would view them. If it was a slide, you'd have the slide projector with the light blasting through. You can make your own slide carry. If you have a traditional flatbed scanner, there are slide attachments you can get. I think Make Magazine did a little how-to hack where you can get some silver paper and sort of make the backing thing that illuminates it. It's a lot of work. So if you've got, say, 75 carousels full of slides that you're sort of looking at, first of all, go through and sort those. What I did when I was faced with over 300, I think, I'm going to send these out. It's about 20 cents a slide, depending on where you send it, but there's some good services: scanmyphotos.com, DigMyPics, Memories Renewed, which I believe is right over next door in Minnesota, does a ton of all kinds of analog conversions, and they will give you a price on per slide. But what a lot of them will do is you send off your slides, they get them, they log them. Some services will let you decide which ones you want to keep. They'll scan them all, and then you'll see the preview, and then you see the duds in there, and you can choose not to have them saved. But what you get with a service is the professionals are used to doing this. They have the equipment, and they also scan everything at a high enough resolution that you can make really nice prints from these slides. Because, as you know, the actual image on a slide is what, 1.5 by 1 inch away. So you have to scan at a really high resolution to get that to be any bigger. And having a service that just does this for their business, they will just crank it through. You know, it may take a few weeks for you to get your stuff back. And you do have to trust sending your media to this company, but usually they FedEx it back and forth. And I did not have a problem when I had it done. And it was not all that expensive when I factored in what it would cost me to buy the equipment to do it, what the time factor would be, the sort of hit or miss frustration factor till you found exactly the settings you wanted to use. I said, I'm going to send these out and help the local economy there.
Talking to J.D. Beersdorfer, consumer technology columnist at the New York Times, finding out how to scan, preserve, and organize our old photos, videos, documents, and more. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you do with old family photos, personal photos? Have you had a project in the last year or so going through stuff, deciding what to keep, what to get rid of, what to scan, how to save it? Do you have questions about how to do any or all of the above? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with New York Times consumer technology columnist J.D. Beersdorfer, talking about creating and maintaining a personal digital archive, what to do with all those old photos, whether printed off or on our computer, videos, and more. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you doing something like that now? Have you found solutions on what to save, how to save it? Do you have questions about how to do it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. JD, let's go to the storage side of things now. You know, I have gigabytes, I think, of photos and videos. I'll have more if I scan that tote full of photos and whatnot. I keep old hard drives around as a backup. I'd like to get rid of them. What are the best storage methods out there right now?
A lot of people are fans of the cloud, you know, the ubiquitous cloud up there. And online storage has gotten a lot less expensive over the years. And Google and Apple or Dropbox, whoever, will be happy to sell you more space. For a few dollars a month, if it's something that you think you want to do. I I usually do an online storage and I'll do a local storage. But with online, if something happens to your house or whatever, you have your all of your precious memories are stored up there in a cloud on somebody else's server far away. So that's something I always keep in the back of my mind, even though it may cost, you know, a few bucks a month. It's worth it for that peace of mind. I also do keep hard drives. Like yourself, I have some of the very small, compact, basic hard drives. But the thing with storage media, as we discovered also from back in the days of videotapes, legacy formats tend to go away after a while. And it's if you had a bunch of photos stored on a zip drive, you know, they don't make those anymore. Mm-hmm. So you really have to be careful when you're deciding how you're going to store these things. A lot of people will do archival CDs and just keep a CD player or a DVD player around for that purpose. But then you also have to worry, well, are the computer makers going to be able to accept you know, attaching a CD player to a computer 10 years from now? So it is kind of worrisome, so which is why I tend to just keep it in a digital format of some type and then keep it on either a solid state drive, a hard drive, the cloud, again, and make sure it's a trustworthy company too, that you have security options in case you do have anything personal there. You want to be able to lock down your stuff and make sure the company's not going to go out of business and take all of your files with it.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Philomena is with us in Viroqua. Philomena, hi.
Hi. So my question is more around editing. I have old 16-millimeter film that was converted to DVD. However, a lot of those films were not in the, you know, some of the scenes are real hard to see or they're dark or whatever. Do you have any suggestions about free, and I want to stress the word free, applications that could be used for editing video?
Oh, interesting question. What do you got?
Free is always a, I mean, there's a lot of open source software. If you are technically inclined, I'm going to go looking. People have probably made some video applications. When I've had to digitize and edit film or stuff that's been converted to film, I've used QuickTime on the Mac before, which usually comes, there's usually a version of QuickTime with the software. The old iMovie program, you can pull stuff in and do some editing there if you're Windows. I have not done a lot of Windows lately, but I think there are probably some applications that Microsoft has made. But it can be very, you know, it's, there's such huge files too. And I think iMovie will let you do clearly like trimming, you know, the bad stuff out of the clip if it's something, you know, you've got a dead spot in the middle of nothing happened and then you just really want to have the highlights. It'll let you trim stuff. And but before you do, you know, just make sure you keep a backup of the film in case you do edit wrongly. I would just browse your local software archives and see, because a lot of people will, software developers are very generous sometimes and they want to share their skills. So much like people who can't afford Adobe Photoshop will find the software GIMP that works for Linux, and it's also multi-platform. You can do pretty much everything you do in Photoshop with that, and it's free because it's open source. So there are probably some video editors out there. If you're looking for audio, Audacity is a great audio editor as well.
Thanks, Philomena. Good luck. Hope that helps. Joyce joins us now in Shatek. Joyce, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Joyce.
Thank you. Yes, hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
I was wondering about, I have some negatives. My grandpa was a photographer in the early 1900s, and I have some negatives that are like probably 18 to 20 inches long, and they're rolled up because they're more than 100 years old. And so I'm wondering, I would like to get them developed because they're history for our area here in Barron County. And I was wondering, what should I do? I've called around to museums, and, you know, there's no help out. Nobody develops negatives very much anymore.
Joyce, interesting. Any advice, JD?
Yeah, so this is undeveloped film that has been, the pictures have been shot, but it just hasn't been developed, or it's negatives that you just need to have prints made from the negatives on the roll.
Now, do you know which it is, Joyce? Are they undeveloped, or you just need some
prints? No, if you roll them out, they're negatives. You can see people and figures in barns and houses.
Okay, so they're film negatives. It may takes a little bit of research, but I might say if Memories Renewed over there in the Twin Cities might do, they do pretty much everything I've thought of that you would want to convert. It's an older format, so they may have to get more information about it if it's not, you know, just like a 35 millimeter, which is a standard. Or see if there are any local photographers or photography schools that may have older equipment that could handle making prints from these. You mentioned historical societies, but maybe if you go more to an educational environment where they're teaching photography and have some of the old historical stuff, they might be able to help you out. If not, I would go to a just call around to a film digitization service and see if you know, people who would normally just make prints from regular negatives, if they could handle this particular format that you have from your grandfather's cameras.
Joyce, good luck. Sounds like a great resource. JD, I'm in a position where I'm just like overwhelmed by the task, the big tote full of old photos. Could you leave us a little pep talk on tackling this and knowing that we can actually get something done?
Just psych yourself up. What I like to do, if I have a, if it's small stuff, there's a couple of phone scanning apps that I use. So like, if you thought I'm going to be training my computer all day, I'm going to be stuck with a scanner. There's a lot of great mobile scanning apps, Adobe Scan, that you can, and Google's Photo Scan too, which is great because it will automatically stitch together like curled prints and glare on photos and stuff and clean them up and make them nice. So I'll just put a stack, have a nice area, clean area, work area, put on some music, just sit there, and whether I'm using the phone or whether I'm flatbedding, just kind of rock out, you know, listen to a podcast, listen to some music, just kind of get into the groove. And before you know, you'll have, you know, 10 or 15 of these things scanned. Once you get the scans on your computer, you can show them off to friends, clean them up, you know, make them look real nice. I think that might inspire you to go on because you're capturing this history. You're putting it in a new format. You can share it with friends and family who never would have had a copy of this photo before. And you can be proud of yourself for that.
JD, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's JD Beersdorfer with the New York Times giving us advice on storing, digitizing, scanning our family photos and videos. Tomorrow on Central Time, a pair of country music songs have gone viral, gotten divided responses over their apparent political messages. We'll look at politics in country music tomorrow on Central Time. Solar panels are emerging as the cheapest method to produce electricity in many markets around the world. That's according to our next guest, who studies technological change and public policy's effects on it. There are a bunch of solar power development projects going on around Wisconsin of various sizes, and that's fueling hopes for cleaner and more sustainable power and for in-state labor opportunities. Some challenges are slowing the transition away from non-renewable sources, including investigations into Chinese labor that produced some of the panels planned to be used for Wisconsin projects. There are currently over 20 solar farms providing energy to utilities in Wisconsin, with more on the way, according to Renew Wisconsin. Want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about solar power generation in Wisconsin, around the country, around the world? Do you generate solar power on your own rooftop or where you work? What was it like to set that up? Do you work in utility scale solar power in one way or another? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Greg Nemen is a professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs, where he teaches on energy systems analysis, policy analysis, and international environmental policy. He's the author of the book, How Solar Became Cheap, A Model for Low Carbon Innovation. Greg, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. It's good to be back.
I keep seeing reporting, Greg, about the surprising to some people acceleration of solar development. Is it going faster than you might have expected?
Yeah, I think it's going faster than just about anyone would have expected. It's growing, you know, in general, about 30% a year, and it's grown that fast for about 30 years. And anytime something grows that fast, you know, like that's like adoption of cell phones and things like that, you expect it to slow down. And that's what people have been predicting with solar for about the last 20 years, and it hasn't. It continues to grow at 30%. So that's why we have solar now becoming considered a potentially central part of the world's energy system, and including in our state as well.
What's driving that?
A few different items. The number one, I would say, is the continued fall in the price of producing solar panels. So they've come down about 90% in the last 10 years. And that also extends to savings in the installation of solar panels. So those have gotten cheaper as well. We also see people becoming more familiar with how with solar power and being able to talk to neighbors who have installed it already to find out who good installers are, when they would expect to get a payback, things like that. We also have supportive policy, and it's coming at multiple levels. We've got state policy that for a while has been there to produce some incentives for installing solar. It's stronger in other states, but we do have state incentives for that. And then we have a big deal about a year ago, the federal government passed the Inflation Reduction Act, so that created federal incentives that are available to Wisconsin energy consumers to install solar. So there's a variety of support for solar. The technology continues to improve. The pathway for continued cost reductions seems clear to most people. And it starts to look like you can configure solar to work with a battery in your basement that's also becoming inexpensive, and electric vehicles that are also becoming less expensive. And so there's a variety of ways that solar is coming into people's lives, in addition to larger scale installations from companies and utilities.
An early knock on the idea of solar power in Wisconsin is it's Wisconsin. We don't always have sun. We have snow that covers things up from time to time, shorter days in the winter with less sunlight. What have we learned over the last couple of decades about whether solar is really viable here in the state?
Absolutely. That's the number one concern people raise. And some of the evidence that you can see that there's ways to address those concerns are look at where solar has been installed. And it's been installed in lots of not that sunny places. You know, the biggest installer of solar for the last 10 years has been China. And northern China isn't that much sunnier than Wisconsin. If we look at Germany, the first large market for solar, that's got less sun than Wisconsin. And same for Japan. So we have examples of places that have installed a lot of solar without a lot of sunshine. And in the last 5 years, we've seen in Wisconsin quite a few companies that are interested in developing solar in Wisconsin. So you can make money installing solar, even in a place that's not the sunniest in the world, like Wisconsin. And then the answer to how you go from being a little bit of solar to potentially having solar being a large part of the whole energy system is that you integrate solar with other sources of energy. So you can have grids like a transmission, an electric grid that connects solar to other places so that if you have a thunderstorm come over and cover up one area of the state, another part of the state that's connected can be producing solar. So that's one soft way to do it. Another stronger way is integrating solar with other types of clean energy, like renewable or like wind power, where solar and wind are not that well correlated. So it might not be sunny, but it's still windy, and that can be in the winter and night especially. And then other types of clean energy like nuclear and geothermal can provide part of the system when solar is not available as well. So if you start thinking about it from a system level where we've got lots of different interconnected sources of electricity, solar makes a lot of sense, even if we don't have to depend on it 100% of the time.
Talking to Greg Nemeth, professor UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs, looking at the rise, the exponential rise of solar power around the world and big in Wisconsin. A lot of utility scale projects in the works or actually online right now. Badger Hollow Solar Farm in Iowa County on the way, Two Creek Solar Park in Manitowoc County. Greg, what are you watching for when you look at these utility scale solar projects, solar farms, whatever we want to call them? Are we getting bigger and bigger in Wisconsin?
Yeah. So those two that you mentioned are the two big ones we have in the state right now. So they're, you know, on the order of 200 megawatts each. You know, there's a gas power plant on the UW Madison campus. It's a little bit less than that. So we're talking about a substantial power station. What I guess the first thing I'd look at is that those were built. So this is when we're talking about like 5 years ago, solar developer companies started saying, look, Wisconsin's got resources there. There's space, there's demand, there's enough sun, and we can make money building large scale solar there. So those two have gone in. So that was to prove that Wisconsin is a place that you can do large solar, that there's a place to do business there. That the panels work with the amount of sunshine, that it's interconnected with the grid, that the regulators can make it work. And so a lot of things have been proven with those first two large-scale systems. As we go forward and we're thinking about more systems of that scale or potentially larger or smaller than that, The two things that I would look at as being really consequential are one, grid infrastructure. So making sure that there's ways that new projects can get connected to the grid and provide electricity to a variety of consumers that might use it. That's number one. And number two is the siting and permitting. So making sure that those who live around the facility have a voice and that their concerns about the aesthetics or the construction effort that goes into it are heard and that they're addressed. And there's things you can do with large solar farms like those too to make them work better and make them work better for the community. And so community engagement's a really important part of it. And that going forward will be increasingly really what determines whether the state has a little bit of solar like we do now or a lot of solar, which is what a lot of states are moving towards.
Let's bring on a caller. David is with us in Verona. David, hi.
Hi. I was just going to tell you about panels that I installed on our roof about 5 years ago, or I had them installed.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about? How did it go?
Well, it was very easy. We got we went through a place called Focus on Energy, which is an advocacy group for solar power. They recommended an installer who came out to the house and very quickly and easily installed 15 panels. At that time, it was about $1,000 per panel, but I think it's a lot less now. So the total cost was $15,000. We got $6,000 in government rebates, a tax rebate and a incentive payment. So it was $9,000 total cost. In the 5 years that I've had it, we've saved $1,000 a year on electricity costs. So we've already paid off more than half of the actual price of the panel.
David, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. Greg, how big a part of the story is personal, you know, rooftop solar like David has?
Oh, that's great to hear from David about that. And I would just, you know, as he suggests, the prices have come down substantially in the last 5 years with the Inflation Reduction Act, a similar level of incentive, about a 30% tax credit, so similar to what he got 5 years ago, is available. And yeah, I mean, the big difference between large scale solar that we were talking about a couple of minutes ago and rooftop solar like David has is that David can tell his friends and his relatives about his experience. He can tell about an installer that worked well with him. He can talk about his energy savings. He can talk about any problems he had. He can warn about installers that might not have worked out so well. And I think that's something that my own research has proven really impactful. And we call it the academic jargon or peer effects, where you're getting information not from a company, not from a university, not from something you read online, but from friends and relatives, so trusted sources. And that's a really important conduit for any new technology to get over the unfamiliarity of having solar panels on your roof and not knowing who to call. So I think David's story is exactly why we see solar spreading in a way that kind of comes from clusters, because people know each other and it's much more likely to have solar installed within a mile of another installation because of exactly stories like David's that that give people a conduit to trusted information about it.
Thanks for that call, David. We're talking about advances and obstacles in solar power generation in Wisconsin and beyond. Greg Nemeth stays with us, professor at the UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs. He researches public policy effects on technological change. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about solar power, in Wisconsin in particular? Do you work in the solar or renewable energy sectors? Join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a solar production facility near you? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation about the development of solar energy here in Wisconsin, how it compares to the rest of the country and the world. Greg Nemeth is with us, professor at the UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs, solar energy expert. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to our callers. Stella is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Stella.
Hi. In 2005, we put a 3.8 kilowatt a PV array on the roof of our garage, and also solar hot water. The array cost, I think it was $30,000, and we got $10,000 in rebates, so it ended up costing us $20,000. And currently we're in the process of adding just a little over, just a little bit more than doubling our PV generation. And that we're going to be adding more panels to the racking on the, expanding the racking and adding more on the garage. And plus we're adding a new kind of panel that is to the roof of one roof on our house, that they're about 6 inches off the roof, and they each have their own inverter. I'm not real versed with all this, but anyhow, gotcha. We're in Sturgeon Bay. We have a city-owned utility, and we have a grid intertie, so when we're generating, we have net metering, so when we're generating, we run our meter backwards, and when we're drawing from the grid, we run forward.
Stella, thanks a lot for the call and sharing your experience. And Greg, yeah, how we integrate a rooftop project like Stella's with our local utility. It's been the subject of some controversy in our state laws. What do you look for when it comes to, you know, can people like Stella effectively deduct from their energy bill when they're selling electricity back to the utility?
Yeah, key issue. But first of all, Stella is a heroic early adopter. If we think of solar in Wisconsin in 2005, that was really one of the first couple hundred systems probably. And so if she and her family are going back to the solar market to upgrade and expand, they're going to find a much better set of panels and much cheaper prices than they did. So that's really impressive. But yeah, it's technically not an issue. We know how to connect a system to the grid. The issue is really on the financial part, and the financial part comes from regulations, because regulators decide, the Public Service Commission decides what we pay for electricity, and they also decide how something like solar gets handled in terms of, do we just pay people to run their meter backwards if they make extra, or do we say it's actually worth even more, like mid-afternoon last Wednesday when it was in the 90s and everybody's using air conditioning, maybe you actually want to pay more than the grid price at that period, or do you give people less than the grid price, which could be the way things are going as well. So there's a few different reactions to how those rates work out. One reaction is if the rates are kind of not as generous to providing net metering, we get less solar. But we might end up in that case getting people starting to get serious about putting batteries in their basements, or taking advantage of a much bigger battery than they could ever put in their basement, which might be in their electric vehicle, and start to store some of that electricity instead of selling it back to the grid at a low price. So there's some pretty important incentives that come from the rates that people get for what happens to the electricity that they don't consume directly.
Thanks a lot for that call. Before we go back to our callers, Greg, I mentioned earlier some federal investigations into how some of our solar panels are produced, many of them in China. There's federal regulations saying, hey, we can't import products made with forced labor in China. There are some solar panels, I understand, waiting for installation in some of these Wisconsin projects, pending the results of that kind of investigation. How big a problem is this, and the wider concern about relying on China for a lot of this technology?
Yeah, I think, you know, I've looked into that a fair amount, and the issue is that some of the input material for solar, a lot of it comes from a province in western China called Xinjiang, where there is forced labor. It's not clear that they're using forced labor in those facilities, because to do that process is mostly about these large furnaces. It isn't very manual intensive, but regardless, there's an issue there, and we don't have transparency from China or from those companies, so there's reason to be suspicious. But the bigger issue is that China's producing 70% of the world's solar panels, and so the question is, does that put us, the U.S. or other countries as well, in a situation in which we might be similarly dependent as we are on oil producers? And I would say right away, it's not the same thing as oil, because solar panels last a long time. So if China cuts off our solar panel supply, we've still got all our existing solar panels. So it's not really a good comparison that way, even though people make that comparison. But we are seeing, because of the federal incentives in the last year, our much more production of domestic solar panels. And so it's not as big as what is being done in China right now, but it's enough to make a difference. And it's enough for China to ever think twice about cutting off our solar supply, because now we can credibly say, you know, if we get cut off from solar panel supply, we can start to make our own because we have something already and we can scale it up in a couple of years. So that's been a big difference over the last couple of years. We're going to have much more domestic manufacturing and getting panels from places other than China.
Talking about the rapid rise of solar power here in Wisconsin and beyond with Greg Nemeth from UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. Back to your calls now. Mike is with us in Superior. Mike, hi.
Hi. There's a building construction issue that I can't seem to get anybody to understand. A flat roof on a building serves two purposes: to keep the water and snow out and to keep the heat in. Roofs generally last 20 years. Some of them go 30 years. When those roofs need to be replaced, nobody's calculating what it's going to take to pull off those panels, put a roof back on, and replace the panels. That's something that people who are in the roofing business can't seem to get an answer to, and I'd like to find out if your guest has any thoughts on that.
Mike, thanks for the call. And I've wondered about this too, Greg. I know roofs have another purpose, and they don't last forever, like Mike says. Are we factoring this into the rooftop solar side of the conversation?
Yeah, well, it certainly saves costs to do the roof and the solar panel installation at the same time. So if people's timing works out, and typically, even if it's close, it makes a lot of sense to do your new roof at the same time you're doing the solar, because, you know, a modern roof could last 10 to 20 years and solar panels are guaranteed for 20 to 30 years. So most of that, if you do it at the same time, you're likely to be on the same time schedule for it. If you put new solar panels on an old roof and then you need to replace that roof and before the solar panels are done, yeah, you would have the cost of removing the panels and reinstalling them, which, you know, could add, I don't know, $1,000 or $2,000 to the cost of the system. So the timing of your roof and your panels is something to take into account, and if you can do them at the same time, it's definitely a good way to go.
Thanks a lot for that call. Greg, a lot of our callers, not surprisingly, interested in personal rooftop solar. When it comes to the utility scale projects we were talking about earlier, are there obstacles you see out there that we're going to have to overcome to continue this rise of solar power in the country?
Well, part of it is there going to be demand for more electricity, because these are big systems. So if we're adding to capacity of the grid, are we going to need that? And our electricity demand has been pretty flat for the last 15 years or so. So that could be one thing that halts it. But on the other hand, we have this looming source of new electricity demand, which is electric vehicles. And we have less than 1% of our new vehicles in Wisconsin are electric vehicles. But in the rest of the country, it's more than that. In other countries, it's closer to 25 or 30%. And that's likely to be the direction that we go as well. So there will be a new source of demand for electricity, which is electric vehicles. And so we're going to need more generation, and solar is a good solution for that. So that's part of the answer. I think that the two big limitations, I would say, are one is on permitting and siting. So making sure that communities are supportive of the facilities that get planned, because they do take space, they take time, there's construction involved, but then they run silently and without any pollution and without much maintenance at all for the next 20 to 30 years. So there's really a benefit after that initial period of disruption. And then the grid infrastructure too, just to the extent that new power lines need to be put in. And so those are also need community input and have aesthetic impacts, and people need to take those into account as well. But in terms of the technology and the need for a clean source of reliable electricity, we've got a lot going for us with solar. And if we start to think about integrating into a larger system that has storage on the grid, for example, when it's not sunny, when it's night, when it's winter, then we can see a lot more solar happening. And that's certainly what's been happening in the rest of the country as well. So the whole country's got about 4% electricity from solar, and we have less than 2%. So there's a ways to go for the state to catch up. So I'd expect more to come on solar in Wisconsin.
Greg, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Good talking to you.
That's Greg Nemeth, professor at the UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs. We talked to him today about ongoing solar power projects in Wisconsin. If you have a story to share on your rooftop or in your community, let us know. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.